I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. Thanks for joining us in an ongoing quest for the awe and wonder that await each of us every day and all around. Awe can be found in all creation, human or wild, vast or small, in spiritual encounters that move us beyond words.
I'm a big fan of climbing trees, so I try and schedule that into my life. So for the last 3 years, I've climbed a tree on the first Wednesday of every month. My calendar goes ding, and I go climb a local tree. And that's a fantastic thing because it gets you away from your email for 20 minutes.
Alistair Humphreys is an English adventurer and a National Geographic explorer. He has rowed across the Atlantic, biked around the world, and even run a marathon in the Sahara. But somehow he still gets a thrill simply being high up on a nearby tree limb in his London suburb.
So it's a bit of exercise, a little bit of childlike fun, but also it makes you notice that the universe has changed. Wow, the last time I came here, the leaves were green and now they're turning golden. Fall is coming, the seasons are changing. So I love my little scheduled tree climbs.
Alistair Humphreys has a solid reputation for awe and wonder reportage from having written dozens of books and articles about his really big global adventures. But his most recent book keeps very close to home. It's titled Local, A Search for Nearby Nature and Wildness. And it's wholly devoted to wonders that are right under our noses, as the expression goes, or maybe I should say above our noses, if we happen to be contemplating our next local tree climb. In order to write this book, Humphreys adopted a systematic method for determining where his local adventuring would take him. He decided he would fill a calendar year with weekly explorations of his own vicinity, plotting out destinations grid by grid on a very detailed map. A project such as his resonates with me in a big way, and here's why. It's because constant wonder will quickly become fragmented wonder if we depend on distant travel to locate marvels, magic, and the miraculous. Can we really locate wonder locally? What if it's all so familiar to us? When was the last time you felt blown away by the visitation of some common animal from the neighborhood, a plant found out in your yard or garden? Alistair Humphreys wants us all to see the wisdom and the excitement in witnessing precisely such commonalities as these.
Yeah, chaffinch is just a standard little garden bird in Britain. Bird watchers lump all these sort of birds together that they call LBJs, little brown jobs, just little brown things. And a chaffinch is actually a bit more exciting than a little brown thing, but I imagine it's generally ignored by everyone. It's sort of got a kind of pinky red tummy, black and white wings, and then a quite a funky pale blue grey head. But it's a very ordinary bird by British standards. It's probably in everyone's garden in the country, but probably nobody would list it as their favourite bird.
Well, you chose to write about it in conjunction also with a butterfly, a red admiral butterfly. And to stop and actually write about your experience on a single day in a precise location and to even care about some, because the butterfly, the red admiral, is pretty common too, I think.
Yeah, it's a pretty common, well, I mean, I say common, butterflies are in terrible decline like most wildlife, but one of the most common butterflies you would see in your garden on a rare English summer's day. They're black with really nice red stripes down their wings and white dots on the end. And they're the sort of thing that unless you choose to remember to notice them, that they just sort of pass you by because they're normal. But when you look carefully, you think, wow, that's actually a beautiful little fellow. And being there reminds you also that it's summer, which is an even rarer species in England. So we have to make sure to appreciate that.
You have had a career which has been extraordinary in terms of global travel. You've been around on so many different modes of transportation as a National Geographic explorer, reporting on what you see and inviting people to see more keenly. The common is not what people generally look at as sexy. They just don't stop to see, you know, we want to go to the pyramids of Egypt. We don't want to see a red admiral butterfly.
Yeah, one of my biggest motivations for wanting to go on adventures and to see the whole world and to travel on expeditions around the world by bicycle or on boat or on foot was very much driven by me thinking that home was incredibly boring, like a lot of young folks across history. Where I lived was the most boring place in the entire universe. And if I wanted to have an exciting life, what I needed to do was get as far away from here as possible, to go out across the horizon in search of adventure, as people have done for countless generations.
But you realize that where you grew up in the Yorkshire Dales is a tourist destination for us Americans. We can't get enough of the place.
Yeah, exactly. Where I grew up, if you Google the Yorkshire Dales, is one of the most beautiful bits of Great Britain. It's lovely rolling green hills, dry stone walls that were built 1,000 years ago, little stone barns for the sheep and the cows that are hundreds and hundreds of years old, funny little place names that come from when the Vikings were busy invading us and destroying everything, but leaving their legacy and a lot of the language of the north of England. So it's an extremely beautiful corner of the country. And to be fair to my younger self, I did appreciate growing up that, wow, this was beautiful and I really enjoyed growing up there. But you reach a certain age when you don't want to be in the Yorkshire Dales. You want to be in San Francisco or Siberia or Sao Paulo or somewhere just different from the everyday ordinariness of right here. T.S. Eliot said it very wisely, didn't he, about the end of all our exploring being to return to where we started and to know the place for the first time. So I definitely think it took me going off around the world and seeing Arctic waste and deserts and oceans to really appreciate, wow, this corner of my country is pretty special too. And so there's that appreciation having gone off and coming back again. But actually these days I don't live in the Yorkshire Dales. I live just in boring old suburbia just outside London. And yet there are also chaffinches and red admirals here.
So let's describe your project. You undertook a concerted effort to stay nearby. And this was after, as I said, marathons in the Sahara, actually running through the Sahara or on a bicycle from Turkey to Italy or all the way over to China. This was you?
Yeah, so for a bit of background, I spent 4 years cycling the whole way around the planet. I've crossed the Atlantic Ocean by sailing boat and in a little rowing boat. I've spent time up on the Arctic Ocean by the North Pole. I've walked through the Empty Quarter Desert in Arabia. So I've done these big distant expeditions and I've been very lucky to make a living from writing about these big adventures. And so my decision to stop all of that and to commit to spending a whole year limiting myself to the one single map that I live on, which measures about 20 kilometers by 20 kilometers, and to see, could I open my eyes and find enough of interest in this tiny little patch of suburban southeast England? Could I find enough on there to scratch my adventurous itch? And could I really pay attention for the first time in my life and find interesting stuff close to home that in some way might be a substitute for disappearing off to the other side of the planet?
You made a decision to systematically investigate the immediate vicinity to see if there was something adventurous there for you?
Yeah. The whole of the UK is divided up by the mapping agency, the Ordnance Survey, invented, I don't know, 200 years ago when we were busy fighting the French to make good maps of the country to defend ourselves from those pesky Frenchies. And so what that means today is that Britain has fantastic detailed maps everywhere. So I got the one for where I live. I've got it in my hand here. So it's a big map that folds out like the size of a newspaper, really. And it covers, as I say, about 12 miles by 12 miles, 20 kilometers by 20 kilometers, divided, and this is quite important, divided into 1 kilometer grid squares by sort of slicing up the latitude and longitude. And what I decided to do was not just to get my map and just immediately explore everywhere, but rather just to do it little by little. Once a week for a whole year, I would go out and explore one of these grid squares. So an area that's only 1 kilometer by 1 kilometer. That's pretty small. You know, that's a few football fields by a few football fields. It's not a big area. But my challenge to myself was, can I go there and see everything? And perhaps if I pay enough attention and I'm interested enough, then perhaps everywhere can be interesting. Even a random little 1 kilometer square of local land on a cold, wet February afternoon. If it's boring, that I think is my fault, not the landscape. So I needed to go there and be really curious and force myself to find interesting stuff once a week, every week for a year, rain or shine, spring, summer, fall and winter.
Didn't you also have other reasons for staying close by home?
Yeah, I did, yeah. There's several. One major one would be a growing concern about the travel industry and the adventure industry's impact on climate. So I've been feeling quite uncomfortable about being part of a business encouraging people to go off all around the world when that is just so harmful. I asked myself, if I love these wild places so much, am I willing to not visit them in order to protect them? And then there are the real life practicalities of just busy daily life, meaning that I'm not free to head off as much as I used to. So there's a bit of idealism, a bit of pragmatism, and a bit of curiosity.
But there's also people in your life. And it seems to me that you were loath to leave them behind and go out adventuring far.
Yeah, a lot of my mad, wild adventures were when I was young and single and carefree, and I now have a family, and it's not really appropriate to be just disappearing off for months on end anymore. So is it possible for me to scratch that adventurous itch, my desire to go new places and to do interesting stuff? Could I squeeze that in the hours between dropping my kids off at school in the morning and picking them up from school later that afternoon? I wondered if it was possible to squeeze a little bit of nature and exploration into my routine life.
Do you remember the very first day when you made a foray out to one of those squares?
Yeah, I remember the first one very clearly because I sort of thought this was an interesting idea to spend a whole year on one local map. I wasn't sure if it was a good idea or not. So as the year progressed, I chose the grid squares that I went to by random, and that became an important aspect of it. But for the first week, to test the idea, I decided to look for on my map for what seemed to be the most boring part of the entire map. So I looked on my map and I found an area where there was nothing. No hills, no forest, no rivers, not even any tracks, just nothingness, a bit of empty marshland. So I went along there feeling a bit like a grumpy teenager being forced out to do a school project, thinking this is going to be a bit boring and a bit rubbish, but let's go and see what it's like. And I forced myself to spend a few hours walking around this cold November bit of marshland and gradually started to notice that the more you look, the more you see. The more you see, the more there is to be interested by. The more you're interested in something, the more curious you get. And so little by little, my enthusiasm started to grow. And I took hundreds of photos that first day and then came home with all sorts of notes. And I carried on my explorations when I got back home with a few hours of Googling as well. So it actually became a two-pronged project that became the weekly visit out to somewhere on my map to see what I could see. I'd write stuff down, I'd take some photos, then I'd come home and I'd Google everything that I saw. Because I'm not an expert on anything to do with nature at all, so I had to learn all this stuff.
What was this marsh? Did you get wet? Was it grey? Did anything come up and bite your ankles?
So two things you need to know about England is, yes, it is almost always grey, and two, nothing will ever come up and bite your ankles. So you win some, you lose some. Them's the breaks, I guess. So yeah, southern England is pretty flat. In November, it's kind of cold, but it's mostly just grey, rainy and a bit windy. During the daytime, most sensible people are at work. And what that means throughout my exploration was that it's particularly in the winter months when I was walking out around the marshlands. And marshlands are not like some fantastic Florida swamps. They're essentially just fields that you'd have cows in that are a little bit wet. So they're not particularly visually thrilling. There's a lot of housing in southern England, so there's lots of electricity pylons. And I quite liked the way the wires of the cables crisscrossed and slashed across the grey sky. And I started to find electricity pylons quite beautiful in a weird sort of way, sort of segmenting up the sky and crisscross symmetrical patterns. So I would see some cows, I would see some fences. One good thing about trying to explore in England is that if there's a farmer's field with a gate and a fence saying keep out, you can, as long as you're being respectful not to damage any crops or cause any problems for any cattle, and you're going to treat the land with respect, I'm pretty open about jumping over said fence and going for a wander around in a way that perhaps you might not do quite so readily in America. So I was pretty free range in exploring the whole of the grid squares.
Well, that's not Scotland, though, and Scotland has this open access code of some sort, and there must be something of a transgressive spirit for you to go trespassing on a farmer's field. Didn't you have little twinges of guilt, or did you kind of hunker down and crawl on your hands and knees?
I mean, the issue of land access became one of the most pressing things that I was reflecting on throughout the year. As you point out, I live on the same island as Scotland. We have the same laws, essentially, except with regard to land access. Scotland has what's known as a right to roam, which is much more like the Scandinavian countries, where they have every man's right to roam. Allemannsretten, they call it in Norway. But with rights come responsibility. If you're going to roam across the countryside, you need to have the responsibility also to care for it, to not leave trash behind, to not leave gates open, to not cause problems, to not trample through farmers' fields. Here in England, only 8% of the countryside is open to people to roam around. And that's never particularly bothered me growing up. I'm a law-abiding guy. We've got a really good network of footpaths in our country. But when I was trying now in this year to really immerse myself in my local and environment and to really connect with the landscapes I lived on in order to start to care for them more and protect them more, it started to really frustrate me that so much of it was off limits. And I can understand land being off limit. You know, if there's a wheat field full of wheat, then I'm not proposing that I should be able to walk through that. And if there's some sort of nature reserve with a very rare species, I don't want to cause problems there. But most of the off-limit land in England is ignored, unused, empty fields. And it started to grate with me that we have such an issue in Britain with nature disconnection. People are so disconnected with nature. It has a really big impact on mental health, on physical health, on our relationship with the planet, on our caring for the nature crisis, the loss of species, which is terrible in Britain. And how can you expect the population to connect with nature when you're removed from so much of it? So the issues of land access became quite important for me. But I also grew up in a farming community, so I'm aware that farmers have got a hard job and they don't want people coming dumping a load of rubbish and trash in their fields. So yeah, trying to see all the different ways in which lots of people want to use our fairly scant resource of land in England was one of the interesting conundrums that this project threw up for me. And there is no simple answer.
With that very first square, way back when you were just setting out to test your concept, your approach, you say that you intentionally picked a place that you were pretty sure would be bland, perfectly uninteresting. But then after that, it became more like throwing a dart to see where it would land on that map each week. Why that?
I like traveling. I like the wilderness. I like cycling and camping. And I'm sure loads of people like me, if you give us a map, we immediately start looking at the map and getting excited and thinking, oh, look, you could go from there to there. And that hill looks fantastic. And oh, that place faces east. You'll get a good sunrise. So I love maps. I love choosing routes and journeys to make upon them. So if you just gave me my map of my hometown, what I would do is I would find the hills and the forest and the beautiful bits, and I'd go explore them. And that's what I've been doing for the 14 years that I've lived in this area. And so what turned out to be a really, really good idea for me in this project was that I decided to choose the grid squares by random. So each week, I didn't just choose somewhere pretty to go to. I essentially rolled the dice and went to where I was told. And yes, some weeks that was a cemetery or somewhere with a McDonald's or a KFC or a railway yards and things. And this was fantastic because this then meant that for the first time I was exploring parts of my local area which I'd never been to before and I'd never been interested in before. But by being forced to go there for a few hours and to look around and try and make the best of this, they often became my favorite grid squares on the whole map, really.
Describe for me how this project looks when you land in a cemetery, for instance?
Oh, cemeteries are fantastic. I love cemeteries. English cemeteries are brilliant. You've got people have been there for 600, 700, 800 years. You read the little inscriptions on the things. I really enjoy that. So I'm always happy to walk around the cemetery. But I'm also became really fascinated by things like industrial yards. I've never really been to an industrial yard. I don't know what goes on in these places. So I was really interested to start looking at these factories. And I really like the parts where some bits have fallen down and neglected and they're broken and there's broken concrete and barbed wire and smashed bottles, because there you start to see plants growing again and trees pushing up through the concrete. And because there's not pesticides and pollution from chemicals from the farm fields, you get a lot more birds and butterflies than you do in other places. And because there aren't many humans around, you get foxes and rabbits, which are what pass our exciting wildlife here in Britain. So I came to really enjoy these broken down places. And another thing that I hadn't anticipated was that they felt wild and a sense of solitude and peace and silence in a way that I didn't get in the very developed countryside that we have. You know, in Britain, even our fields, our woodlands, they're all managed. They have been for centuries. So to get a sense of actual wildness and peace, it was the broken down bits behind the railway lines where I felt most as though I was exploring. So I came to really, really like the bits that weren't classic in nature. And I'd quite often take my little camping stove and just brew up a cup of coffee there just to force myself to sit still and listen to the silence for 10, 15 minutes. And by silence, I don't mean silence at all, because where I live, you can hear in the distance, you can hear motorways, freeways, you can hear sirens. You can usually hear a chuk-chuk-chuk of a train somewhere in the distance. But suddenly by being a few hundred meters away from these roads, by being, say, behind the old factory, that suddenly felt silent. And weirdly, nobody on the planet knows where I am, which is something that I've experienced when I've been out in a desert, but never when I've been within half an hour of central London. So I came to really like those little pockets of wildness.
Do a little role play with me. You're going to be my wonder coach. You're going to be my awe instructor. Just this last weekend, my boy and I went into some very remote mountains. We hiked in with our packs. In the morning, I couldn't sleep. I got up at 4:30. I went out in the darkness. Couldn't see a thing on the ground, but the sky was brilliant with stars. And I said to myself, I'm not terribly comfortable here because it's cold. It was above freezing. But I can see these stars, I can see the occasional bats going by, and I thought, I'm just going to watch as the morning comes. This is an enviable position to be in, where somebody should be just at peace and finding serenity, and I found myself, to my shame, becoming impatient. What was I to do?
I think what you were to do is to go back in time by to a time before smartphones, telephones, because our lives are just so fast now. I mean, I wouldn't be too hard on yourself. I can imagine if I was in that situation, I'd think something like, ooh, if I just spend the next 20 minutes sending some emails, then the sun will be ready to rise and I'll take a good photo for that and put it on Instagram and it'll all be great. So I think, yeah, I don't think it's a reflection of you. I think it's just a reflection of our lives. They are so ridiculously fast. Rush, rush, rush. And I think that's probably one of the reasons why going out to do the things like you did, or me sitting behind a factory for a bit, is so precious, because we kind of find it hard. I had to really regularly during this year force myself to slow down and to appreciate that, hey, I'm a lucky guy. I've got an hour now to wander around this woodland. It's 1 o'clock in the afternoon. All my other friends are sitting in their office at work. I should enjoy this and be grateful. And yet I would still find myself thinking, oh, I need to rush home and send more emails. I mean, what a ridiculous approach to life that is. But yeah, I'm trying to slow down and to simplify and to appreciate little bits of nature and wonder and enjoyment and happiness, even in the very mundane landscape I live in. That was right at the core of why I wanted to do this project.
over this calendar year of local exploration, you had a surprising number of encounters with wildlife apart from birds. Not always ankle-biting mammals, but what about the fox who had the misfortune of darting out in front of your moving bicycle?
Yeah, sorry, fox. Yeah, so at the start of my year, I really felt that where I lived was not very wild, not very adventurous, quite boring. But as I started to really pay attention and be out in it, I think the fact that I scheduled to go out once a week and do my best to immerse myself really helped. So yeah, one week I was out cycling late at night in the dark, and I cycled over a fox. I mean, literally, dumf, dumf, one wheel, the next wheel, over a fox. Poor little thing. I went back, and then I looked after it, and there was no fox. I went the next day, no sign of it, so hopefully it was a tough old fox. But yeah, I had that. And then one week I was out running in a wood. I almost stood on a badger. A big white, black and white badger. Now, a black and white badger, that's our equivalent of a grizzly bear in Britain. That thing, that sort of thing does not happen close to London. So that absolutely terrified both me and the fluffy badger. And then very shortly after that, a big stag beetle, which is by American standards, all of these things are pathetic, but it's about the most epic of insects we have, landed on me while I was running and I squealed like a little kid. But it was exciting, and that's wild. That's nature and raw animal stuff happening to me, whilst in all of these instances in the distance, I'd be able to see the flashing tower blocks of the big city not very far away.
Part of the raw nature that you bumped up against included wildlife, just as you've described, living things. But there's also wildness and joy and freshness in something as elemental, I think, as water. And there's something about you that really gravitates towards water. It pulls at you. And in the book, you talk about wading in streams. There's a story, actually, you prevailed once on getting a cabbie, I think it was, to jump into a canal with you, probably against his better judgment.
Hey, you've done some good investigating into my life. Yeah, so I love swimming in outdoor stuff. And by swimming, I mostly just mean jumping in to rivers, lakes, ponds, oceans. Just jump in, submerge my head. That's all I need. I come out from there and that's my therapy session for the day done. I love doing it. So yeah, it's something that I always try to do. And a few years ago, I was on my way to do a speaking engagement in the Netherlands. So I took the train from England to the Netherlands, and then at some station, some taxi guy picked me up and he was driving me to the venue, and it was a nice day. And in the Netherlands, you drive over lots of canals, and on the canals, there were young kids jumping off the bridges into it. And I was sitting in this taxi going off to some boring corporate event thinking, oh man, I wish I was jumping in the canal. So eventually I couldn't take it anymore. So I said to the cab driver, please stop at the next canal. I want to jump in. And he thought I was weird, but, you know, the client was always right. So he stopped and I said to him, and you know what? You should join me. So this taxi driver just thought I was so strange, but good credit to him. He was a good sport. So we both got out of the cab, stripped to our underpants, jumped into the canal with a bunch of sort of teenage kids, and then got back into the cab, dripping wet and laughing, and off we went. And it was fantastic. I loved doing that. But what I really loved about this was a year later, maybe the photo popped up on this taxi driver's phone. I'd never seen him since, but he sent me a message a year later to say, hey, look what we did a year ago today. I've been telling all my friends about this. And this is something that's often come up in my experience of doing small little adventures, micro adventures, like you spending the weekend that you were telling me about just now, the camping. You probably didn't sleep very well. You were a bit cold. You come home a bit tired. Maybe it's easy just to stay at home with a comfortable bed and watch Netflix. But you know, and that taxi driver knows that a year from now, you remember these small little experiences and they grow to being magnifying and much greater. So yeah, I'm very, very glad that the taxi driver and I jumped into that canal one day. It was a lovely thing to do, not just for the few minutes of jumping in, but now I'm getting more pleasure from it again, remembering it several years later.
I do have ancestors from Yorkshire, in fact.
Ah.
And to me, it's often been important to sort of retrace the steps of where people, ancestral or just, you know, generations ago, where people have walked. And you dedicate a lot of attention to footpaths. What is it about just walking where other feet have gone, sometimes in your country, 200, 300, 400 years previous?
Yeah, we in England, in Britain, and particularly England and Wales, have a fantastic privileged network of footpaths that you have permission to go down them, and they've been there for hundreds of years, and, you know, they often go straight through the middle of farmers' fields, or occasionally even through the back of someone's backyard. These are everywhere. They're wonderful, but they are thousands of years old. I mean, some of them are 7,000 years old. The old Bronze Age routes from one settlement to the next. And it's interesting that they're usually up on high ground, and then you get the Roman roads, which are 2,000 years old, and there's loads of them around Britain, and you know them because they are dead straight, boom. And then you get the meandering little footpaths that go from one village church to the next, and then within villages you get the nice little meandering footpath that goes from the church to the pub. And so these are fantastic footpaths because they show you the countryside, but also, as you say, there's that connection with people who've been following in the same footsteps for time immemorial. On one week on my exploring my map, I was out on my bike and I was on a really busy road. It wasn't a nice, relaxing place, but it was so straight that I could tell, this must have been a Roman road. So I did some Googling, and sure enough, 2,000 years ago, Roman soldiers had walked this path on their way heading up through Britain from the south coast. And that suddenly transforms just a normal, busy road into something really special. Think, wow, people have been walking up and down here, getting sweaty like I am now, for 2,000 years. So thinking back is fascinating, but also to then think forward, to think, what will people be doing down this road in another 2,000 years? And then suddenly, the day has transformed. Rather than just you're cycling down a boring and slightly busy road, you're suddenly time traveling back to the Romans and imagining forwards to what your country will be like in thousands of years to come. So yeah, I think that the shared experience of footpaths is wonderful. Someone wrote somewhere that essentially you can't make a footpath by yourself. It's a communal effort over hundreds of years, and there's something lovely about that.
I want to shine a spotlight on another incredible show from the BYU Radio family of podcasts. It's called Top of Mind, and it resonates in a big way with those who want to engage with the important tough issues facing our communities, but who are dismayed by polarizing and divisive approaches to these issues. Each week, Top of Mind tackles one tough topic. Award-winning host Julie Rose talks with guests about complex, challenging perspectives, and the Top of Mind experience doesn't aim at persuading you to change your mind. Instead, it opens a door for empathy and clarity in the interest of becoming better citizens and kinder neighbors. Listen to Top of Mind wherever you get your podcasts. We now return to Constant Wonder. Now, there was one day when you came across some kids. They should have been in school. They had what you call a catapult. We would call it probably a slingshot, a little device for shooting little clay pellets, and you engaged with them. I just bring that up because I want you to talk about the beauty, the awe of strangers and seeing other people and sometimes very young people. I don't know that you set out to spend time with people, but you did.
Yeah, I think one of the failings of the project, if that's not too harsh a word, was that I didn't involve as many other people in it as I would have liked to have done. Every time I met people, it was interesting. The two kids that you refer to, I found one day this giant bit of, we call it fly tipping, when people just dump all of their trash rather than take it to the council to process it properly and pay for it, then they just dump it by the roadsides. And you get this, and this was an epic mound of this that had been set on fire. So I was looking at this huge mountain of trash, and along came these two young kids. So I was chatting to them, kind of curious, guys, shouldn't you be in school? But I didn't bother doing that sort of boring old man question. I was just chatting to them and about what I was doing. And they started offering to show me around. They're like, oh yeah, look, if we go through that fence there, you're not allowed to go through there, but I can show you a pond, or we can go around there, there's a good wood. I mean, you're not allowed to do it, but it's interesting. And that it made me remember how good it is to try and take a childlike approach to exploration. If you think about kids, kids are curious. They really want to know what's over the next hill, and they're enthusiastic and they get excited about everything. If you think of really small kids, like 2-3-year-olds, you try and walk round the park with them, it takes you an hour because they're looking at every single puddle. And you're like, come on, hurry up, kid, we got to go. But the kid's much smarter. The kid is down looking at the beetles and the marvels of the universe. So yeah, trying to be childlike and curious is a good thing to do when you're out exploring in nature. So meeting those two youngsters was a good thing for me, just to remind me to be childlike and curious and enthusiastic with my explorations.
Well, they're still at an age when they'll pick up anything they find. They'll inspect it like some found treasure, you know. And that brings us to your interest in something called mudlarking.
Yes, mudlarking it's a word, as far as I know, mostly connected with the River Thames in London. And 200 years ago, 300 years ago, back in the day when there were lots of poor little urchins, an entire industry was little kids, poor women, walking up and down the riverbank at low tide, looking for anything that they could forage and then make some sort of living off. Today, people do mudlarking for fun. And if you Google it, there's a fantastic book called Mudlarking, in which this lady, she walks up and down the Thames at low tide in London, and she finds Roman coins and porcelain pipes from Charles Dickens' day and Shakespeare's day and all sorts of stuff that when I read this book, it just made me so fascinated with the ancient history that's everywhere in Britain. So I decided to try some mudlarking and the river that crosses my map. And I found some treasure, if you can call broken bottles from the 1980s and a shopping trolley and an old golf club, if you can call things like that treasure. But the main reason I was doing it was because I had this idea of finding Roman coins. But in my heart, I knew that once I started, I would be bored and impatient within 10 minutes. And that was why I wanted to force myself to do this, to deliberately choose to just walk slowly down the edge of a riverbank for an hour or two and make myself slow down. Because even though I was impatient, I knew that later on I would appreciate that. And the notion of time sits quite heavily on this project, really. There's me, quite a hyperactive guy, always rushing around. And then there's thousand-year-old churches that you could go into, the doors would be open, and I'd love to just sit in the pews there. I'm not a religious guy, but I like religious places, to sit in the church pew. And what I really liked was the stained glass windows. And I'd look up at the stained glass windows, the light shining through and showing the colours on them, and the beautiful scenes of usually biblical scenes. But what struck me from those was trying to make myself think how a rural, ill-educated, church-going peasant would have felt when they first saw those hundreds of years ago. And to my mind, it's like their version of sort of 4K YouTube bright colour, to suddenly see a story blasting out in bright coloured glass must have been wonderful for them. So I tried to make myself get into their way of seeing things and to see the beauty and the power of the storytelling of those stained glass things. So yeah, I enjoy the oldness of my map as well.
So, I am a religious guy, and when I sit in front of a stained glass window, I look at the light coming through, and I'm willing to say that apart from any institutional religion or apart from any theology, something happens to me. And one of the best words I could ever apply to it might be spiritual. Does something happen to you along those lines?
Yeah, very much so, definitely. So I have a very good friend who does similar sort of stuff to me, who's a very, very committed Christian, and he gets cross with me when I throw the word pilgrimage around too lightly. But I do often think of my journeys as being a form of secular pilgrimage, you know, the searching, the striving, the struggle, the hard work, the slowness, the simplicity that goes into some sort of higher outcomes.
Alistair Humphreys is an adventurer and a writer, well known for his work as a National Geographic explorer and a fabulous conversationalist as well, as you've just heard. He's author of multiple books, including his most recent, which is titled Local, A Search for Nearby Nature and Wildness. Today's episode was produced by Eric Schultzke and Mamie Teeples, with sound design by James Call. Thanks for listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. Constant Wonder is a production of BYU Radio.